In today's episode, I'm going to tell you another migration story. It's also like prior episodes in the sense that it's about resilience. The two central figures in the story are Olivier Le Tardif and Roch Manitobowicz. Both men seem to thrive in the war-torn frontier landscape that existed during the 1600s. Of course, they experience challenges, but they always seem to be able to adapt quickly and find new ways to move forward. I found their stories to be inspiring for the current challenges we face in society today. Welcome to the Maple Family Treehouse. I'm Kale, your host. The story I'm bringing you today is both an immigration and a migration story. And with it, I hope to illustrate one simple truth. The relationships of my ancestors, whether friendly, for business, romance, or political in nature, have all influenced my identity and a sense of place that I have today. The story begins around 1602, when Henry IV of France put Samuel de Champlain in charge of mapping the waterways in and around New France. Aymar de Chaste, governor of Dieppe, had obtained a monopoly of the fur trade and set up a trading post at Tadoussac, where the St. Lawrence River meets the Saguenay River. He invited Champlain to join in an expedition he was sending there. Champlain's mission was clear. It was to travel the waterways in New France and choose a site for a large trading post inland via waterways. Champlain set about his mission. He hired an assistant, Olivier Le Tardif, my 10th great-grandfather. Le Tardif partnered with Roch Manitobowicz, my 11th great-grandfather, on a different branch. It was documented in Jesuit journals that during the earliest days of the fur trade, Champlain placed young men to live at Huronia, a Huron-Wendat community near current-day Penetanguishene, Ontario. The intention was for the young men to learn the Algonquin language to assist in trading. This documented strategy makes it likely that Olivier Le Tardif, who was known to have spoken some Huron, Algonquin, and Montagnais languages, was also placed at Huronia, where he learned these languages. Once the young men were conversant, they became interpreters for the 100 Associates Company. Le Tardif was chosen to be a personal representative and interpreter for Samuel de Champlain. Roch Manitobowicz's history is not well documented. However, the most reliable sources state that Roch was born around 1600 in an Algonquin village on the shores of Lake Huron, Ontario. It has been surmised that Roch, a Christian name, refers to Saint Roch, the patron saint, a name he most likely adopted through baptism. Also, we can deduce that he had been in the company of Jesuits. Being baptized, he would have understood and could speak at least some French to meet the prerequisite religious teachings before being baptized. Both men were primed and ready for the job ahead of them and scouted out locations for trading posts to support the expanding fur trade. Although Le Tardif was experienced in the Montagnais, Algonquin, and Huron languages, it was Manitobowicz who acted as interpreter for Le Tardif. Together, they both scouted the region from Quebec to Lake Huron. The two men traveled for several years as representatives for the company, Roch as interpreter and Olivier as company man. One can only imagine the types of dangers and adventures they had and the people that they met and interacted with. Their travels were highly successful, and eventually Olivier Le Tardif was given a promotion to head clerk of the Company of 100 Associates, forcing him to settle down into a more sedentary lifestyle in a more administrative position. Roch also settled down, going to join his people at the Aboriginal settlement at Sillery, near Quebec. It is at the Sillery where Roch met his significant other, Auchi Bahanuk Oweyu, and fell in love. The Sillery was a place where Jesuits attempted to convert Aboriginal people to Catholicism. The aim was to instill an agricultural lifestyle. in the hopes of replacing the semi-nomadic life of the Algonquin and Innu people and more easily evangelize them. The land was granted as a seigneurie to Christian Aboriginal people under Jesuit supervision. By the 1670s, alcoholism, epidemics, and the difficulties of adapting to a sedentary lifestyle had depopulated the settlement until a number of Abenaki refugees from New England sought shelter there. By the late 1680s, the last Aboriginal peoples had left Sillery, driven away by epidemics and unproductive agricultural lands. The Jesuits remained, though, and they built the Jesuit House, which is now a museum in the town of Sillery, Quebec. As you might expect, the Jesuit kept some records of baptisms and weddings between Native people, but there is no documented marriage record for Rock and Wayuu. Not much is known about Wayuu's early life, but in Sillery, Quebec, where Wayuu meets Rock, Manitobowitch, Abenaki peoples migrated to New France because white settlers encroached upon their traditional territory. The Abenaki gradually withdrew from the coast of Maine, USA, to New France, today Canada. For the most part, they settled at Bécancour and Sillery, eventually migrating to St. Francis, near Pierreville, Quebec. The Abenaki formed an early attachment with French missionaries and became entangled in frequent war with the English until the fall of New France. But as I've learned, writing stories about many of my ancestors, that love blooms amidst the most chaotic circumstances. While there is no marriage record for Rock and Wayuu, there are records for the births of their children. Their first child was Marie Olivier Sylvester, who is my 10th great-grandmother. Allow me to digress here. I gave my daughter the middle name Marie. It's my mother's name, along with many other women in her family. At the time, I had no idea of the origins of the name. Marie Olivier Sylvestre seems to be the original Marie who initiated the traditional use of Marie in this branch of my family tree. Hence the reference to the branch of my family tree as the Marie line. And now I understand the origins, and I'm excited to pass on the story to my mother and my daughter. With such historic significance, it's no wonder that the name Marie has been passed down to almost every successive generation to the present day. There is no less than 9 Maries in this line. My daughter's middle name is Marie after my mother, whose mother was also named Marie Yolande, and my maternal grandmother, and so on, back to Marie Sylvester. Of course, beyond my family tree, the origin story to this name is religious. The name Marie is a shout out to the Virgin Mary, as stated in Marie Olivier Sylvester's baptismal record. But back to the story. After years of rough and rugged work, Rock and Le Tardif remain close friends, even after their business together ended. Years of traveling and working together had forged a strong bond between the two men. Olivier attended Marie's baptism and chose the name Marie in honor of the Virgin Mary. Le Tardif was named the girl's godfather, and as was the custom at the time for a godparent, he conferred his name Olivier onto Marie. The missionary performing the girl's baptism added another name, Sylvester, meaning one who comes from the forest. Marie's early childhood would have been one filled with family, likely in a longhouse built near Jesuit buildings in the settlement. Religion was an important part of life at the Sillery, as was trade, and most of the Hurons at the settlement also had small farm plots to work. As Marie reached the age of 10, she was legally adopted by Olivier Le Tardif. Rock's old friend was generous and knew that Marie had the best chance of success if she was educated and reared in the same way as a French girl of means. Olivia placed her as a live-in boarder and student with the Ursuline nuns at the Ursuline Monastery. The school was funded by a missionary group of Ursuline nuns in 1639 under the leadership of Mother Marie of the Incarnation. The school is one of the oldest institutions for learning of women in North America and is still in operation today. After some time at the Ursuline school, Marie was sent to live with Guillaume Habou and his wife, Marie Rollet. Guillaume Habou was a company man, working with the Company of 100 Associates for some time, and even receiving a land grant from Champlain. Olivier Letardif knew Guillaume likely because of the company association and considered him a close personal friend. Guillaume's wife, Marie Rollet, had been a widow, and when she married Guillaume, she was much older than he was. Being past childbearing years, the couple had no children of their own, but housed many orphans and native children being taught by the Jesuits. Marie Rollet is listed as a godmother to many converted native children. Once Marie Sylvester was educated in how to run a homestead, she eventually married Martin Prevost. This marriage marked the first in the history books of Canada, where at the time there was a disproportionate number of men to women. Eligible women were often contracted to come over from France to marry colonists. There were without doubt couplings and relationships between male settlers and Indigenous women. Many of the couplings between the French and natives were not officially documented, but on November 3, 1644, when Martin Prevost married Marie Olivier Sylvester, it was the first officially documented marriage between a French person and a native person in Canada. Marie and Martin settled down to start their own family, enjoying high status in their community at their home in Beauport. The land had been granted to Martin by the Company of 100 Associates. Martin's job as clerk meant that he was likely the very person who put together the equipment and supplies for the Maisonneuve expedition that established the colony at Montreal. It was a tumultuous time, with pressure from warring Indigenous tribes, the ongoing war with the English, and competition for resources. It became more and more difficult for the Company of 100 Associates to maintain their monopoly. Still, Marie and Martin had 8 children together, but a series of tragedies left their mark on the couple. In 1661, Marie and Martin lost 3 children in 1 year. A girl, 12 years old, died in January, and 2 of her younger siblings, a 6-year-old girl and a 4-year-old boy, passed away on the same day in March. With all of the comings and goings to the settlements and the lessened immunity of children with Indigenous heritage, it's likely that an epidemic of some sort killed the children. There were many young people who died in this area during the same time period. It must have been devastating for the couple to face this loss while still needing to continue with their lives and raise their surviving children. Surely, this loss and the difficult times took their toll on Marie. She gave birth to Marie Thérèse, my 9th great-grandmother, the couple's youngest child, in 1665, and barely 3 months later, Marie Sylvester passed away. She was in her late 30s. Martin must have been crushed. Not only was he trying to provide for his family in this difficult world, but he also lost 3 children, his wife, and now he had 5 small children to raise on his own. The Company of 100 Associates was in serious financial straits, but fortunately, Martin was already established as a farmer and a trader in the community. When the Company of 100 Associates dissolved in 1663, their charter having been revoked by the church and the crown, it opened trade to an extent that had never before been experienced in New France. Martin continued his work and remarried and lived to be 80 years old, a ripe old age for the time. He stayed at his home in Beauport until he became too ill to be alone and was moved to Hotel Dieu. Martin died there on January of 1691. The story does not end there, though. To bring things full circle, Martin's daughter, Marie Thérèse, married Michael Giroux on the 18th of August, 1683, in Beauport, Quebec. They were the parents of at least 7 sons and 5 daughters. One of those daughters was Marie Giroux, who married none other than François Letardif, the grandson of Olivier Letardif. Their marriage brought together two families with a long associated history and bound them together as a family. I think Letardif and Rock Manitobowich would have been smitten to see their grandchildren brought together in marriage. At the time the story takes place, there was no signed treaties on paper. What was in place at the time was the dish with one spoon wampum belt. The wampum belt was, in effect, a record of a diplomatic agreement. Like all diplomatic agreements written on paper, its purpose was to ensure that the parties would keep to their end of the bargain, and ensuring the memory of the agreement would be preserved. Perhaps the best-known wampum belt is the dish with one spoon wampum treaty. It was made between the Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabe people prior to European contact. The dish represents the land that is to be shared peacefully, and the spoon represents the individuals living on and using the resources of the land in a spirit of mutual cooperation. One of the core values within the idea of a dish with one spoon is that those who use the land should not abuse the land. In other words, individuals and groups should only take what they need from the land, and everyone on it, to ensure its future health, our future health. Given the hunting and trapping by Europeans for profit and so much displacement of indigenous communities by war and European settlement, it is safe to say that the dish with one spoon wampum treaty was not being upheld. On the other hand, relationships like that of Letardif and Manitobowich give me hope that mutual respect is possible. In the age of reconciliation, I admit, I sometimes have wondered if there was ever any friendly relations even to restore. But this family story gives me hope that reconciliation is possible, not only on a systemic level, but in our hearts.